Well, hello there, and welcome to True Crime Bones, the Waldo Cafe, with me, your host Marissa, also known as Bones. So in the previous episode, we got to the part where the journalist borrowed his gun to reach Dory. I mean, who doesn't? So Gordon Winter, the journalist, aren't you supposed to be smart as a journalist? Don't borrow your gun to people. That's also what we learned in the previous episode. Don't be borrowing guns. Was, you know, kind of in trouble, you know, because the fact the gun he borrowed to his friend Richard Aubrey would be used to kill Waldick not long after. So in today's episode, part 2, we shall be continuing. So with that being said, let's get into it. So, Gordon Winter had no illusions about the men he had been dealing with. In fact, he went on to admit, after the killing and his detention under the 180-day law, "If I had not been held in protective custody by police, there is no doubt that I would have been killed by London gangsters." Well, I mean, he had no illusions about the people he was dealing with, but yet he would borrow them his gun. Because that makes sense. Later, Winter reaffirmed what he thought about the gang and how its members would react to Bradbury. You know, aka they called him at that time the Squealer. "Bradbury would be maimed for life or murdered if he walks out of this court," Winter said. "These people must be made an example of. He is a marked man." I mean, I think it's time for Bradbury to go back to London. But anyway. And to drive home his point, Winter disclosed that underworld characters had been shot all night because of the Waldeck case. There had been several gangland shootings after Bradbury had talked to the police. Can you think, one man being murdered causing so much under murders? It's a ripple effect. Another Johannesburg newspaper reported, gave evidence for the state with further revelations of the modus operandi of the London gang. He said he had been beaten and kicked by Richard Aubrey in a Hillbrow flat because he had written a story on the aftermath of the Great Train Robbery. Yes, let's kick a man for doing his job. Great. From the state evidence, it appeared that the London gang was in some way connected with the killing of Tom Waldeck, and that Bradbury could have been mere cog in the wheel of this powerful machine. Compulsion was to be Bradbury's defense against the stinging accusation hurled at him. Much play was to be made of this when his defense counsel pleaded for his innocence. If he even gets to be like, I'm gonna say no, but you are found innocent, but he should be found guilty of stupidity. Anyway, but submitted prosecutor Croch Bradbury had made a statement. There's so many Bradburys, no? Made a statement to the chief investigating officer, Lieutenant Colonel St. J. Petal, which amounted to a confession. Similarly, the evidence he gave in court, which I'll tell you like later, was a confession. The state was adamant that Johnny Bradbury was a socius criminis, an accessory, you know, better word, accessory, and was therefore undoubtedly guilty of murder as charged. He knew full well what he was doing and what was going to be done on the fateful night that Tom Waldeck was killed, and therefore had the necessary intent for a murder conviction. Because, obviously, because he could have been like, nope, let's not do this, let's alert the police. Compulsion claimed the state could not be entertained as a defense on a charge of murder. Mr. Kroch rose to his task at the suggestion that compulsion was the excuse for killing a man in cold blood. In this case, no compulsion was present, he said. The term is too strong under the circumstances, and I prefer to call it undue influence, he argued. Bradley, on his own evidence, admitted that he was never forced to join the notorious London gang. The fear, if any, which Bradbury claimed had been a dominating factor, was not nearly as great as he would have the court believe. Why had not Bradbury consulted with anyone about his involvement in a plot to kill? He had ample opportunity of doing so, and the fear of reprisal from gang members was not particularly strong in this case. Well, I mean, he did, like, get beaten and, like, with the glasses and anyway. But this case, no. There was no immediate fear of death or harm to Bradbury or his family. In fact, the people who he said would have harmed him were far away in England. Mr. Justice Snayman, who had sat silent through the piercing state argument against the man in the dock, interrupted the indignant state prosecutor. He asked a pertinent question. Does it not boil down to the fact that you cannot take a life to save the life of another? I mean, this man is spitting. Mr. Kroch replied, was affirmative as he could make it, and the legal authorities supported this view. He said that Bradbury was involved in a premeditated offense, one of the most serious we know. All the features had to be taken collectively. Taken thus, said Mr. Kroch, it would be stretching the imagination to say there are extenuating circumstances. By the way, if you don't know by now, I'm Afrikaans. Just want to add that in there. I write this stuff down. But when I have to, like, say, it's like my brain doesn't want to work. Anyway. So, with those circumstances, you know, serious, all those, the car trip to Melrose that night was made for one purpose only, murder. Yeah, it wasn't to go get cum KFC, it was definitely murder. Bradley got involved with the gang on his own volition. The threats he claims he was under were remote. The fact, 6,000 miles away. I mean, like, and back then, they didn't just quickly do a flip-flop fly. Aubrey only uttered threats relayed from London. I mean, what a waste. Bradbury kept the engine running and the door open to help the murder escape. The state had brought forward a mountain of evidence to show its opinion that Lawrence Bradbury was guilty of the crime of murder. The crime had been proved. Waldeck was shot in the doorway of his home. He was shot not by Bradbury, but by one Harry Prince, the not so princiest one, an alleged gangland gunman. But Bradbury, acting in common purpose with Prince and according to a premeditated plan, had driven Prince to the Waldeck home. He had kept the car ready. Evidence was that matchbox was placed under the open door of the car to facilitate a quick getaway. When I was checking this, like, as old car footers, I don't understand that. What does the match do? Finding pictures as well, it doesn't work for me. Anyway, while Prince had perpetrated the foul killing, He had received a reward for his part in the killing. This evidence was given by him in his defense. Bradbury was therefore guilty of willfully and with intent killing and murdering Thomas Ernest Holmes Walden. The defense had other ideas, a powerful plea for his innocence and later for leniency was to be made for the former Cockney Barrow boy who stood dolefully in the dock. Bradbury told his story in a soft voice. Only occasionally did he become somewhat agitated, and then his Cockney slang mystified the judge and assessors and probably the majority of eager onlookers. Yep, probably me as well. I'd be one of them. He recalled that winter's night when his newly acquired acquaintance, Gordon Winter, took him by car to the house of a Johannesburg attorney. He said he thought the visit had some connection with his libel case. He had consulted Winter about the newspaper reports that he was Charles Wilson, the great train robber. When they arrived at the house, Winter went in and he remained seated in the car. Charlie Richardson came outside. He had known him since their school days. Richardson said, and I quote, "There's been a little trouble and I want Waldeck killed. Waldeck has cheated me out of 17 grand, end quote. Thank you, boy. Just a little problem, you know, just a small teeny weeny murder problem. Really? Well now, 17 grand was a lot of money. Yes, a ton of money back then. In fact, its sterling equivalent back then was obviously 17,000 euros. But that was then, I don't even know what it is now, with the inflation rates, with everything. A lot of money, like a lot. Let's just say it like that. This flashed through Bradbury's mind, as well as the fact that he had met Waldeck, albeit briefly, in a Hillbrow hotel. The fact was, on Bradbury's version, that Waldeck had to be killed because of 17 grand, and this was the only possible motive given throughout the trial for the killing of Tom Waldeck. Bradbury had a ready reply to the proposition to put him, you know, I'm gonna say I couldn't do it. His excuse, if we can say it like that. Richardson was joined by the cohort, Richard Aubrey. He interjected, saying, and I quote, "So that means you will be disobeying old Charlie," end quote. And no, it's definitely not Charlie from 2.5 Men, just saying. Bradbury was the man on the spot. He was told by the spokesman for the gang on that cold, fateful night that they might have to send for a top-class killer. I wonder, did they, obviously back then, no, but like in today's time, did they get ratings? 5-star review for, how do you know the top class? Bradbury was told in no uncertain terms that if they had to get that man, he would be maimed for life, along with his wife and children. Bradbury appeared sincere when he told the court that he was unwilling to shoot Waldeck, but that he agreed to do so after dire threats had been made against his wife and children. However, in the eyes of the court, there had to be no doubt about his sincerity if he was to be successful in his defense, that the threats had been the sole motivation factor in urging him to assist in the killing of Waldeck. The day after the alleged conspiracy, a pistol was delivered to him. Gang members were on hand to inform him that it was the gun he had to kill Waldeck with. I mean, you just get it like served up. There you go, that's how you do it. They said there would be some profit in the killing. He would get a new house. He was already staying in a house in a fashionable northern suburb of Johannesburg. I mean, what more? He would get a house. It's not like he's struggling, but you know, Bradbury had visitors almost every day. They included Richardson and Aubrey. They asked him when he was going to do the shooting. And Bombridge said he persistently made excuses. And just imagine how that conversation go. Just chilling, having a few beers, smoking a few cigarettes. So, when are you going to do the killing? Because that was now smooth. Anyway, his assignment with death preyed on his mind. It should, you know. On June 7, 1966, at about midnight, he went to Waldeck's house. He fired several shots into the house before returning home. He had two visitors the next day, Richard Aubrey and a man called Berman. They acquired his activities on the night before, and he told them of his attempt to carry out the shooting. On the attempt, he did it. Two visitors didn't believe him. They said they had checked his story and accused him of being a liar. They threatened to tell Charlie Richardson about it. And I would know what that would mean, he said. Well, we all know what that would mean. You die. Bradbury said Richardson apparently heard about the miserable failure as a killer. Imagine that, like you can't even... The message was conveyed that Richardson was annoyed. He had re-emphasized his instructions. Bradbury must do his job. Imagine like doing like a civil suit, like, oh no, going to... I'm like, I'm sorry, but I'm being mistreated at work. For why? Keep telling me to murder someone. I mean, just, that's horrible. So, with this, you need to do your job. Bradbury was at his house when Harry Prince... Seriously. Imagine just swapping it, Prince Harry. Harry Prince arrived. He had known Harry from the Soho days. Harry said he had come to South Africa to take Bradbury's sister-in-law back with him to London and to make inquiries about the transport business. Bradbury might have thought there was more to Harry Prince's visit than these urbane things, but he gave no indication to the court. In his mind, he was still the man who had to kill Waldeck. There were more phases to the projected killing. Several times, said Bradbury, he was taken to Waldeck's office building. He was left a gun in hand in the basement to wait for his victim, but Waldeck never showed up. I mean, sometime you would, like, there should be a time in your life where you're just like, you know what, this is just not meant to be. There's been so many times, just not now. This should have been one of them. On the night he drove to Waldeck's house, he circled in several times, but couldn't get a shot in. Bradbury's procrastination on his evidence was at least partly successful. Word came to him on the gangland grapevine. Yes, even back then they had a grapevine. That none other than Harry Prince would do the killing. Not to be confused with Prince Harry. On June 29th, 1966, Bradbury had three guests at his home. Prince, Aubrey, and Berman. They said he must go with them to a car hire firm. He refused, but they warned him that he was too deeply involved and that it would be fatal for him. To cross to the police. Quickly to go to the police, you know, like, you can die. Bradbury went with the three men to the car hire firm. They returned with a Chevy. I'm not good with God. It's a Chevy, okay? The other words, no. Bradbury was ready to receive his instructions. He was told that he had to drive the car while Prince was to shoot Waldeck. The shooting wouldn't be fatal. However, Waldeck would only be wounded. He would be shot in both legs. Clearly, they kind of messed that one up. Bradbury was left alone with Harry Prince. Aubrey and Berman said they had to leave to establish an alibi. At 6:40 p.m., Johnny Bradbury and Harry Prince set out to their mission. Prince was well prepared. He had a pistol, rubber surgical gloves, and a silk stocking among his equipment. Because you just don't do murder without a silk stocking. Bradbury had the keys of the car. They drove to the well-lit house in Aaron Avenue, Melrose. Bradbury circled the block before stopping. Prince had a good use for his equipment. Silk stocking over his face, rubber surgical gloves on his hands, and a pistol cocked and ready. The operation was pretty simple. Prince got out, leaving the car door open, with the matchbox stuck under it, and proceeded to the lighted house. I'm still struggling. I'm not like with the matchbox. These old cars and cars itself. My mind just don't. So, with the matchbox there, him going, shots were fired, and Prince returned, and Bradbury drove off. The crime had been committed, but had Bradbury been guilty? Technically. He had driven the freaking car, but under what circumstances? Would any other man with a wife and children have done differently? I don't know. Good question. That's why I'm not a man. Where's a wife and children? What degree of compulsion had been behind his actions? Well, the freaking house, I would say, but okay. Bradbury choked with emotion when he told the court, "I know I'm going to be shot. My wife has been warned that she's going to be killed. You can never get away from them." Well, you were like kind of 6,000 kilometers away from them, but okay. So the them was the gang, obviously, which he played a dominating role in his life and had led him to help in the fatal shooting of Tom Waldeck. And that, my people, is why you don't join the gangs. He said he had met Charles Richardson a long time ago when they were schoolboys. They lost contact with one another, but met up again in 1960. Richardson was in the scrap metal business, and Bradbury was in the trucking business. Trucking business is something I know a lot about, actually. Bradbury agreed to take Richardson's scrap from London to various factories. The renewed friendship blossomed. Yeah, because that's the type of friendship you want blossoming, eh? Bradbury was promised the bright lights and easy life. Charlie Richardson gave him a job as a manager of the night spot at Shirley Ann. But there were penalties to be paid in the big time. One golden rule was that you never crossed the gang. Bitches get stitches. Bradbury wanted to pull out the Shirley Ann. He was approached by the younger Richardson, Eddie. You were given a job, you want to leave the job, you're screwed. You know, don't join gangs, people. So you plan to put out? He was asked and he nodded and was hit with a knuckle duster. Actually, I have a knuckle duster. I don't understand why people use knuckle dusters, because that gives you more. You, the person using it, I think it's more painful for you than the person you actually hit if you use the knuckle duster. So, a few members of the gang were willing helpers in holding his arm down while it was cut with a razor. When he was trucking, said Bradbury, the police came to him and said they had an idea. Something illegal was going on, and as he was in the trucking goods at night, they wanted him to make a statement. Well, but Bradbury was confronted by boss Charles Richardson. He said if he made a statement, he would know what to expect. Yeah, I mean, like, beating, cutting. I know the deal. okay, sign the papers. So Mr. Mike Hannon, youthful defense counsel for Bradbury, posed the question, what do you expect? What do you expect, people? But Bradbury, a reply, a bloody good hiding. That was his reply. Really? Bloody good hiding? Not the cutting, not the... No, he would... Let's just do bloody good hiding. But Bradley also made a statement about his trucking activities, only he made certain of not mentioning Richardson. Because, well, we all know what happens if he would. After his initial hidings... Yes, back then they called it hidings. Still get hidings. No, that man was beaten beyond. Obviously, his lines, Bradbury was told by Richardson that he would have to run the scrap business without being paid. I mean, like, seriously? First you beat me, now you're taking my money? What kind of savagery is that? Bradbury protested feebly, but knew that he would have to succumb. I mean, yeah. Otherwise, his trucks would have been burned, and he would have caught another hiding. Seriously. Don't join gangs, people. Hidings were a dime a dozen in gangland. Just love the old time. But I would say this is pure Afrikaans. Jes gebliksem. But hidings were, yeah. Anyway, take Harry's Diplock, for example. He managed the Shirley Ann as well. But in a rash moment of temptation, ran off with £300 pawned. Of the takings, this man is stupid, straight up. The gang caught up with him in North London. They broke his arms and kicked in all his ribs. Richardson said the beating was a lesson to all members of the gang. I mean, first of all, you joined a gang. Ish. Not a way to go. But then you want to try and steal from the gang? What kind of level of stupidity is that? So, Bradbury recalled when he drove long distance trucks for a straight company, meaning, you know, like straight, like, legal, something we're not used to in this situation. Richardson told him he wanted him to hijack a truck because he wanted the goods inside for a client. It's just no end with that man. Bradbury said he was unwilling to agree to this as he was working for a reputable firm. This brought him another lesson from the gang. The boys held his arms on a bar counter. They cut the tendons at the base of his left thumb with a broken bottle. They couldn't even do it like, at least click with the something sharp, something. The court was hushed as Bradbury told the sordid story, but the judge intervened. Why didn't you go to the police? Said Mr. Justice Neyman. It wouldn't be any good. Are you trying to say that British police are all corrupt? Judge asked. No, it's just the local ones who get paid by Richards. Sorry, even though it crystal cracks me up like constant. No, it's just the small time ones. It reminds me so much of home. So, the police aren't corrupt, just the small time police, okay? That's what we learned here. Just the small town ones that get paid for Richardson, explained Bradby. Scotland Yard is never told, but I had gone to the top police, I would have been maimed or shot in 24 hours. Literally our life is right now. When the gang became angry, you know, you better freaking watch out. Court spectators gasped when Bradbury told the tale of a man called Sanders. Because there's not already enough names in this. I'm sorry. I couldn't stop. I just had to add everything. So I know the name's all over the place, but the more the merrier, I guess. Eddie Richardson was running a protection racket. Sanders had to collect the protection money each week. But one week, he gave Eddie 50 euros, less than he should have. Richardson's mob got Sanders up in a club, said Bradbury. I was made to watch it as a lesson. They nailed him to the floor through his knees. You know, sometimes you just, when I read this even, you just feel pain. And I just felt that, and I felt that every time, like, my knees feels that, my soul feels that. Anyway, the gang, of course, had more civilized methods of dealing with offenders against the code. Any organization has to have rules and regulations. Bradbury said special courts were held by the gang. They are just like the court, sir. There is a judge, jury, prosecutor and defense counsel. They stole their robes from the Old Bailey to try people. I appeared for the defense in 2 trials, but lost them both. Eddie Richardson was the judge. Charlie Richardson always sat on the jury. So you never won anyway. End quote. This is what the life of the Soho gang was. Bradbury had described it graphically. His account was exaggerated, or could there be such a ruthless gang in the modern day and age? Well, in that modern day and age of 1966. But in today's modern age, yes, there could be. And so, so much worse. Especially in Cape Town. The gangs in Cape... They don't mess with them. You just literally look the other way. Captain B. van Neerde, one of the investigating officers in the Bradbury case, was called as a surprise defense witness. He said, and I quote, "I knew I was dealing with the likes of Richardson. We had established that this was a merciless gang. They will go to any lengths to exterminate anyone who is an obstacle to them," end quote. On Bradbury's evidence, therefore, it was this powerful gang with its barbarous methods of instilling fear into its members and of gaining revenge for any misdemeanor which had compelled him to play the part he did in the killing. Bradbury had admitted that he had received 100 rand after the killing. Didn't he, like, Bradbury, like, early on, he said 25 pound, now it's 100 rand. Make up your mind, man. He had found the money in an envelope at his house. It had been left there by Harry Prince. There was no indication of what the money was for. I mean, obviously he should know, but yeah. Harry Prince said it was to buy himself, you know, Bradbury, a drink. What kind of freaking drink is that for 100 rand? What is that fancy champagne that people in America were drinking? Cristal? Did he buy Cristal? Because, like, for a drink? You know. Bradbury had kept the money, but it was argued in his defense this was after the event. What had to be considered most seriously was Bradbury's state of mind before the event and the forces which had played such compelling part in this action. Bradbury pleaded that he was now in worse position than he had ever been before. Really? I could think of the fact that when your arms were cut, but each to his own. He said, and I quote, "I'm going to be hanged for something I didn't do, or be shot if I walk out of this court. I just know I will be killed. I am what is now known as a screener, and it is recognized that I will be a dead man if I walk out of here. This is the custom of the underworld. End quote. Well, he wasn't wrong when he said, like, he's in the worst part of state. He's, yep, that is, it's bad. The judge queried this fear of Bradbury's heart. If you had got away with this killing, would you have just gone on killing for Richardson? You ask. Which is a fair point. I mean, like, if you did once, why won't you continue doing it again? I mean, you've proven yourself to Richardson over and over. Once you are with them, you just have to keep running, replied Bradbury. Exactly. So he would continue killing. At the close of the defense case, Mr. Justice Stayman said he would like counsel to address him on extenuating circumstances. You know me in those words? He posed this question. If a man premeditated the killing of another to save his own life and the lives of his family, could that be extenuating circumstances? So philosophy. I mean, Shakespeare almost. Mr. Mike Hannon replied, I shall argue that the accused is not guilty. I shall say an induced mind cannot be said to have entered a plot with a common purpose. I shall say he had no intent. The defense is that in fear he was forced to take part in an illegal act. I shall submit that there was never any agreement on his part. Unquote. Was compulsion a defense to murder charge? If it had never been like authoritatively decided in South Africa, courts that it was not a defense to murder, argued Mr. Hannon, Bradbury's supposed common purpose with Prince could only have been entered into about an hour before the killing. Just in case you've forgotten, remember this is like in 1966. Okay. If a common purpose was the argument of the state, why not charge Bradbury and Prince in the common purpose with all the members of the gang? Because you can't do that. Gang members be getting away with it, but let's try. Mr. Hannon pleaded that compulsion was a defense if the accused fell short of being the actual killer. For example, if he was an accessory in an American case, compulsion had been accepted as a defense for being an accessory. Furthermore, said Mr. Hannon, if Bradbury had refused to carry out the role and his wife had been murdered, it could not be argued that the gang would still not have murdered Waldeck. It's also a fact, you know, true. The basis of a common purpose, this is why I'm not going to be a lawyer ever. The basis of a common purpose with Harry Prince was an agreement, and the fact of the matter was, argued defense counsel that in the hour or so before the killing, Bradbury had been under duress and could not have entered into an agreement with Prince. No, said Mr. Hannon. In fairness to Bradbury, the total influence on him since his London days had to be taken into consideration. And it was unfair to say that because Bradbury entered into a criminal conspiracy in London, he would eventually commit murder. True. Just because I start eating marshmallows doesn't mean like in 5 years I'm gonna be addicted to sugar and, I don't know, stealing marshmallows, I guess. You can put it like that. So, and there was no question of murder when Bradbury joined Charles Richardson in an illegal nightclub venture in London days. But let's be honest, if you join something illegal, you better be expecting some murder somewhere. It's illegal. That goes with it sometimes. Mr. Justice Naaman interrupted. But he had a criminal mind before he drifted into the gang. He already had criminal convictions. Now that is a point. But had he not tried to escape from the gang?
No, emphasized the judge. The gang brought him out here, and his confession, when Winter fetched him to see Richardson, he said he knew he was to see Richardson. These are not the actions of a man wishing to escape. Mr. Hannon explained that Richardson, who had a respectable front in South Africa, ordered his frightening men to kill Bradbury. Had the death gun long before the killing, but did not kill Tom Waldeck in that time. As long as the gun was in his hand, Waldeck was safe. It was clear that Bradbury wouldn't do the shooting. Perhaps, reported the judge with a half smile, because he was a bad shot. You know, when judges can be funny. The brow of the judge was knitted, and there was no smile on his face when he questioned counsel on extenuating circumstances. Mr. Hannon, he said, have you the right to kill me to save your wife and children? I can understand you giving up your own life to save them. Have you now, in this case, the right to kill Waldeck? You admit Waldeck was kind to you. He was an innocent man. We admit taking the money afterwards, said Mr. Hannon. That was morally reprehensible, but we were forced to fear to play a minor role in the murder. No, replied the judge. You have the wrong approach. It was morally reprehensible to kill another man. And if your argument was true, and all the gang were before me, the only one who could get the supreme penalty would be Charles Richardson. All the others, like Prince, could say they were motivated by fear. Mr. Hannon nodded. This was possibly true. I mean, yeah, this is a freaking great-ass judge. He reminded the judge it was a man's duty to protect his family, and Bradbury had attempted to do that. Before adjourning to consider the verdict with the two assessors, Mr. Justice Snyman indicated that they accepted that Bradbury had a fear of the gang. But this was not the end. Could he not have taken steps to get the assistance of organized society to protect himself? What is reasonable to believe that an anarchist criminal gang could rule an organized society, or that in the United Kingdom a great society was ruled by criminals? It's so nice. Like back then, they could ask that question. Now we all know. On May the 2nd, 1966, the main criminal court in the Supreme Court, Johannesburg, was packed with more than 300 people. Yes, back then, that was a lot. They stood shoulder to shoulder in the public gallery, where on the other days, only a handful of spectators watched proceedings. Many more people, unable to gain admission, stood in groups outside the courtroom. Journalists hurried to the court, early to get seating on the crowded press benches. Yay, me, I need first. Counsel for the prosecution and the defense chatted to one another, and a third advocate sat in court. He told the judge he was holding a watching brief on behalf of Mr. Charles Richardson of London. He had received instructions to do so by London firm of solicitors. Damn, it's like this man is literally got his finger in each pie and ice cream bowl. Serious allegations had been made during the trial against Mr. Richardson. They were so serious that they might embarrass Mr. Richardson at a later stage. He shouldn't just be embarrassed, he should go to jail. Sheila Bradbury was one of several hundred who peered towards the dock where Lawrence, aka Johnny Bradbury, chatted to his police guard. He appeared unpurposed, but both his wrists were bandaged and his right arm was in a sling. There were rumors that he had attempted suicide, but whatever the truth was, he was now in the dock facing the three men in high bench. There was a tense silence in the court as Mr. Justice Snyman summarized the evidence. He told of Tom Waldeck's business associations. It was obvious, he said, that Waldeck was the associate with Charles Richardson in certain business ventures in South Africa. It appeared that at some stage there was friction between the two men. They differed over voting rights in a company and over some wrong never clearly established done by Waldeck to Richardson. Mr. Waldeck had told the court, Mrs. Waldeck had told the court that her husband had been associated with some Londoners. I mean, it's because that was his business. Richardson, Paul Berman, and Richard Aubrey, but she had not given details of their relationship. What part did Bradbury play against the background? The judge said evidence of the part played by Bradbury in the killing came largely from Bradbury himself. He had been a director in one of Waldeck Richardson's enterprises, but had been dismissed. He had spent some time as a mercenary in the Congo, but had then returned to South Africa. At the end of May 1965, Bradbury had been approached by Richardson and instructed to kill Waldeck. He agreed reluctantly because of his fear of reprisals against himself and his family. He delayed taking action against Waldeck for considerable time. He was told later by Richard Aubrey and Paul Berman, representatives of Richardson, that they had brought out Harry Prince to do the killing. A plan was made. Bradbury was to drive Prince to Waldeck House, and he was told that Waldeck was to be shot in the legs, but he didn't believe this. He thought that Waldeck was to be killed. You know, that is why when you give information, make sure you give the details right, you know? I mean, that just cost a man's life. Try and do it a bit. On the evening of the killing, Bradbury drove Prince to the Waldeck home. Prince got out, and while he waited, as we know, for him, Bradbury kept the engine running and the passenger door open by putting matchbox on it, as we know. The judge peered across the crowded courtroom. That conduct of Bradbury, he said, made him a socius criminus, you know, an accessory. And he was clearly as guilty of murder as Prince. But what of Bradbury's state of mind? The judge said that the offense had been twofold. In the first place, it had been argued that Bradbury had acted under such great compulsion that he was incapable of forming a legal intention and was therefore not guilty of murder. In the second place, it was argued that if he were guilty of murder, the compulsion constituted an extenuating circumstances. What other evidence apart from that of Bradbury was there of this compulsion? Winter, the journalist, had told of the workings of the London gang. Certainly, Winter's evidence supported Bradbury's contention that he feared Richardson. Winter spoke as if he was an authority on the gang, and yet his evidence had been that when he had come to South Africa, he was suspicious that the gang was mainly involved in money matters and not murder. For my part, said Mr. Justice Snyman, I have a feeling in regard to Mr. Winter's evidence that the reprisals he speaks of are considerably exaggerated. Which, yes, Also, it's a gin rest. What do you expect? Dr. Van Gas, the insurance investigator, so I forget about him, had also thrown some light onto the subject. He had been told by Bradbury that he was afraid of reprisals, that he had wanted to commit suicide, and that he was prepared to go to the police to get the matter of his chest after he had got his family safely to England. The judge said that the court accepted this evidence of Dr. Van Gas. Mr. Justice Snyman inclined his head towards Bradbury. Why had this man, who on his own evidence had grown up in fear and had been motivated by fear to act against the law, not gone to the police for protection? The judge said it would have been reasonably to expect Bradbury to have sought police protection during the gang and days in London. When Bradbury had been questioned about this during the trial, he had retorted with a very serious attack on the British police. He had accused the police of corruption and added that some policemen were on the payroll of Richardson. By now, I'm thinking Richardson is owning me. Richardson is someone owning like Two Gunbone Podcasts, because this man is everywhere. The court could not accept this explanation, said the judge. Bradbury had grossly exaggerated his feelings about the British police. The court had gained the impression that Bradbury was a dishonest person who was prepared to tell lies. I am not prepared to believe that he was left in a position where he could not call on the police for protection, said the judge sternly, you know. And when Bradbury became involved in the murder plot in South Africa, why had he not warned Waldeck personally? I mean, he could have been like, warn a brother, send a note, send a pigeon, something. Surely this would have been like the best possible action to take. Alternatively, Bradbury could have gone to the South African police, either personally or anonymously. The matter could then have been investigated, and the South African police would most certainly have afforded protection for Bradbury and his family. The judge said that he was not prepared to accept that such a complaint would have gone unneeded, or that the police would not have taken it seriously. There was no doubt the fears and reprisals Bradbury spoke about were exaggerated, added the judge. When Bradbury spoke of reprisals, he apparently meant a good hiding or something like that, but not death. There was no threat of death, which showed that Bradbury's fears were exaggerated. Yes, man, you can lose an arm, a leg, and everything, but don't worry, we won't kill you. Just, like, hang you for life. The judge summarized some of the salient facts of the case as they had been shifted by him and the two assessors. Bradbury had taken part in certain illegal activities in London, quite voluntarily. And he had come to South Africa and had become involved in a murder plot. Imagine them, how messed up you go from one place, making literally from one country to another country, causing issues. Okay, so after some hesitation, he agreed to the killing, but eventually played the minor role in the murder. I mean, he still murdered, like helped. He knew that Prince was going to kill Waldeck and actively assisted him. After the fatal shooting, he had fallen in with arrangements for an alibi. He had been given money and he kept it. Two of the most unsatisfactory aspects of Bradbury's evidence were his failure to report to the police and his failure to warn Waldeck. Mr. Justice Snyman concluded that after consideration of these matters and all the relevant evidence, and having regard to the long period of time between the planning and carrying out of the killing, and Bradbury's failure to escape or make a report to the police, the court found there was insufficient compulsion to act as a justification or an excuse for Bradbury's part in the murder of Don Waldeck. Bradbury was guilty of murder as an accessory. Were there extenuating circumstances? This was a vital decision for the court to take, for it could mean either life or death for Johnny Bradbury. A judge has no discretion but to pass the death sentence if there are no extenuating circumstances. No matter how many times I say that word, it still gets me. If there are mitigating factors, a long term of imprisonment is the most likely sentence. Mr. Justice Layman said that the court, he and two assessors were satisfied that Bradbury had been influenced to some or other degree by the threats against him and doubtless feared for the safety and perhaps even the lives of his wife, his children and himself. Bradbury, it should be remembered, had been offered an indemnity if he were to give evidence for the state. This he had refused to do because of his fear of reprisals. And this was an important factor in his favor. Because, you know, it shows. You wouldn't even do that. It showed that there was some substance in his fears. You know, like, that is for real. Richardson is for real. He ain't messing around. The judge announced that the majority of the court, in fact, the assessors, had reached the conclusion that the fear that had been in Bradbury's mind was sufficient for finding of extenuating circumstances. But, added the judge, in his own view, Bradbury had exaggerated this fear and he felt that it did not constitute extenuating circumstances, you know, Therefore, the decision of the court by a 2-1 majority was that Bradbury was guilty of murder with extenuating circumstances. If Johnny Bradbury felt any relief at this decision, he did not show it. He stood expressionless in the dock as the judge continued solemnly to address the court. In our law, said Mr. Justice Snayman, the crime of murder requires normally that a court should impose the death sentence. But our law also allows a court a decision in discretion where the trial court finds that the murderer acted under extenuating circumstances. But as the judge pointed out, it was left to him to impose the sentence because we don't have juries, remember? In your case, he added, the circumstances are your fear arising from your knowledge that the gang of which you were a member imposed serious reprisals on any members of the gang who disobeyed orders. These reprisals include murder and maiming of disobeying members and their families. I accept that that is so. But after all, Bradbury had ample opportunity to escape from the gang. The fact showed, said the judge, that he had taken on the task of an executioner to save his own life or the lives of his wife and children. If members of society and citizens of a state are allowed to kill another to save themselves or others, then surely we are marching towards a state of anarchy. Bradbury had been given at least a month to escape after he had been told to kill Waldeck, but instead he had chosen to follow the dictates of gang of criminals. It seems to me that the court can never allow anyone to do what they have done. You have taken the life of a man. You took it deliberately and with premeditation. The judge's view was that in an ordered society, no government or police force could allow a private and unlawful organization to create the state of affairs deposed to by Bradbury. This would mean anarchy and total lack of authority. I mean, yeah. A stunned courtroom heard Mr. Justice Snyman pronounce that, in his opinion, the presence of an extenuating circumstance, people, you better forgive me for that word, did not make his unnecessary for the court to pass the death sentence. Still, Bradbury showed no emotion. I think that man was basically shitting himself at that time, like, he couldn't show any emotion. He was asked if he had anything to say before his sentence was passed. His soft, cockney voice was hardly audible in the massive courtroom as he replied, "The only thing I could say is that I want to apologize to Mrs. Waldock." Oh, that's so sweet of him. That's actually nice. Sheila Bradbury sat in the public gallery. She sobbed uncontrollably. I mean, obviously, her man be sitting there. The judge sentenced Bradbury to death by hanging. Bradbury was moved to the death cell in Pretoria Central Prison. He was to pass a lonely existence there for many months while further legal processes were being taken to save his life. If they failed, a day would be appointed for ending the life of the young Londoner. An application for leave to appeal on behalf of Bradbury was rejected by Mr. Justice Snyman in the Witwatersrand Supreme Court. The door appeared to have closed on Bradbury, but there was still a slight opening. Now, direct appeal was made to the Chief Justice and was granted. The appeal by Lawrence Bradbury against his death sentence came before the Chief Justice, Mr. Elsie Stane. Mr. Justice Van Blerk, you see, this is when I'm trying to go from just keeping it English. I forget, like, I'm Afrikaans, and that's an Afrikaans name. Van Blerk and Mr. Justice Holmes, not Sherlock Holmes, just to let you know, in the Appellate Division of the Supreme Court in Bloemfontein on November 24th, 1966. Each of the learned judges gave separate judgments, dissecting for the last time the facts of the unusual case. The Chief Justice emphasized that this was a deliberately planned murder. He added, and I quote, "Leaving other considerations aside, the participation of the appellant Bradbury in taking Prince to the scene of the murder, keeping the engine of the car running and the door open in order to facilitate escape, effecting the escape and assisting Prince in his attempt to establish alibi could be sufficient to justify sentence of death. In this case, of course, there are the usual factors of influence of fear and reprisals on the one hand, and on the other hand, the need for a sentence which would be a deterrent to this kind of gangsterism, so disruptive in its effect on the rule of law and on the precepts of the lives of civilized men and women. Weighing the one against the other, there would be nothing so unreasonable in the conclusion that sentence of death should be imposed as to justify a finding that the discretion to impose such a sentence has not been judicially exercised." End quote. Those were the words of Chief Justice. He added to the deliberate planning of the murder. As a highly significant factor, Mr. Justice Van Blerk concurred with this view. He pointed out that far from taking a moral stand at the critical moment of the murder, Bradbury, on his own evidence, had actively assisted Prince, the alleged killer. He had also given help before the murder was committed. He had assisted in arranging an alibi for the culprits, and after the killing he had received a reward. Mr. Justice Van Blerk said, "It would appear that in the lower court the defence did not rely on the point that
The delay in committing the murder was due to Bradbury's moral objections, nor was it relied on or even mentioned in the petition to the Chief Justice for leave to appeal. Had Bradbury offered moral resistance, all that he had said in his petition about the delay was that despite threats and his terrified state of mind, he resolved to play for time. Mr. Justice Holmes passed a dissenting judgment. He said the sentence should be fair to the state and to Bradbury. It should fit the criminal as well as the crime. As to that, is there any human being who utterly immune from inclination and temptation to all wrongdoing? The measure of his resistance is the measure of the man. The appellant Bradbury was a party, albeit not in a dominant role, to a gangster murder. It weighs the scale, you know, of reckoning heavily against him, but his resistance for some weeks must not be excluded from the other scale. In the final balance, on the one hand, this was a dark and evil deed of nature rare in this country. It requires robust deterrence to inhibit its further importation. On the other hand, the appellant's moral blameworthiness, as distinct from his legal culpability, is reduced by the extenuating feature that twisting in the coals of fell circumstances, he resisted his instruction for some time, and also by the extenuating fact, as found by the majority of the trial court, that in the end, he did what he did through fear. In the result, blending a measure of mercy with the justice of punishment, I would spare his life and sentence him imprisonment for 20 years. But the decision of three appeal court judges was 2-1 against Bradbury, and the sentence of death passed on him by Mr. Justice Slayman was upheld. Man, can you just imagine your life in the hands of, like, these three people? Just three people. I thought, like, getting a downvote on someone not wanting to listen to my episodes is bad, but I mean, this is bad. All hope seemed lost for Bradbury. There was no further recourse to the courts, and the hangman's noose hung over the young Londoner. But there was one person who had not lost hope. Sheila Bradbury. Because you can always count on love. 6,000 miles away, sent a petition to South Africa's state president, Mr. Charles Robert Swart, pleading for her husband's life. She perhaps knew better than anyone else how hopelessly her husband had been caught in a web of London's gangland. In South Africa, there were many people who voiced her plea that Bradbury had been a mere cog in a wheel of an all-powerful machine. The revelation at this trial had already brought about fresh investigations into the activities of the South London gang. How could a man who had helped so much in uncovering this evil organization be made to pay the supreme penalty? On March 12, 1967, a brief announcement came from the South African Department of Justice in Cape Town. Bradbury had been reprieved. His sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. Bradbury was removed from the death cell in Pretoria Central Prison, where he had been for 10 months. Sheila Bradbury, with the three children in London, heard the news over the radio. When it was confirmed, she remarked, "This is the most wonderful day of my life." In the wake of the Bradbury trial, there were deep stirrings in London, culminating in what came to be known as the Tortoise Case. What's your case, my bad? What's your case? London underworld men, headed by Charles Richardson, heard a British judge at the Old Bailey castigate them. You terrorized those who crossed your path in a way that was vicious, sadistic, and disgrace to a society. One is ashamed to think that one lives in a society that contained men like you. All the gangland members received stiff prison sentences. Eddie Richardson was in prison for 10 years. His older brother, Charles, guilty on 9 charges, was jailed for 25 years. This brought to an abrupt end to the nefarious activities of a gang believed by the police to be one of the most powerful in the world. Back then, by the way, not now. In the end, life imprisonment in South Africa, lasting about 15 years. Leader Charles Richardson will be in jail a whole lot longer than his former school friend and henchman, Johnny Bradbury. My folks, that is it. I know I said like I want to do 2 parts, so it's not that long. And the second part ended up being hella long. To the point I'm literally laying on the bathroom floor. Because my legs literally got numb. I felt tingles. But we've done it. Done the case. There was no prince. There was a Harry prince, but not a Prince Harry. And a Richardson, which probably, I feel like, that man is so many fingers, so many pies and ice cream pies, that he is probably the owner of 2 trombones. And my name ain't Marissa. It's Richardson. So, with that being said, you made it to the end. You are absolutely legendary. Thank you so much. You guys are amazing. And remember, crime never sleeps in South Africa. Ta-da!